This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Google dives deeper into the healthcare business. Small businesses are feeling good. Plus, what's in a name when it comes to fintech? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, November 12th. Good to have you with us. Let's start today exploring feelings, specifically how small business owners are feeling about the economy. They had a more positive take on the future in October compared to September. That's according to a monthly survey from the National Federation of Independent Business. Respondents said they are making capital investments and raising employee pay, or at least planning to, but their number one challenge? Finding qualified people to hire. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on that.
Things are looking up at Clean Choice Energy.
I would say that we're feeling really optimistic about where we're at right now and in the next 18 months or more.
Kate Colarulli is chief of staff at Clean Choice. It offers renewable energy sources. The company has 30% more employees than it did last year, but she still has a dozen positions to fill.
There really is a stiff competition, and the candidates we're interviewing are interviewing at other firms as well.
Nearly a quarter of businesses in the survey said their top concern was finding qualified people, either to grow the business or even just to maintain it, according to Joe Galvin, chief research officer for advisory firm Vistage.
Chances are you're hiring to replace someone who left your organization to go somewhere else.
To attract people, Clean Choice Energy is focusing on its green ethos.
That's not something that every organization is able to offer.
30% of small firms said they've increased compensation to attract workers. Rebecca Hamilton is co-CEO of WS Badger. It makes organic skincare products. She says the company's increased pay and benefits.
We have an in-house daycare center. We have flexible hours. We have an on-site gym, on-site yoga classes, on-site Aikido.
The NFIB says small businesses are paying for higher compensation with higher sales and savings. Joseph Bersuelas, chief economist with consulting firm RSM, isn't sure this is sustainable.
They're willing to offer more compensation, but at the end of the day, they're likely not to because of a slowing economy and a contraction in positive earning trends.
In other words, small businesses can afford to fight over talent as long as consumers keep buying. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
By the way, the fastest growing segment of workers by age is people over 55. We want to hear from those of you in that age group who work part-time. So if that's you, please get in touch at marketplace.org. And Google is making another big move in the healthcare business. The company has been running a behind-the-scenes partnership with the giant hospital chain Ascension. The Wall Street Journal was the first with this story, which both Google and Ascension have since confirmed. The initiative, Project Nightingale, gives Google access to patient data from Ascension's 150 hospitals and more than 50 senior living facilities, and it helps Ascension manage its patient data. So, what's in it for consumers? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
Here's the promise from Google and Ascension. With all your healthcare data in one place, it's easier to analyze. They can look at all the medications you take to find dangerous interactions. Vivian Ho is a health economist at Rice University.
They can find patterns, detect things before they go wrong, and give advice to healthcare providers on how to improve care.
Or maybe Google highlights lab test results, complaints about symptoms and medications that didn't work, and recommends a test that shows early-stage cancer. Ira Reingold heads the National Association of Consumer Advocates.
I mean, I think the overall goal is a good one.
But he also worries about data breaches. And what if your insurance company finds out you're tagged as a cancer risk?
Will that person then have higher insurance costs because we've now identified them as somebody who is at a greater risk?
Google and Ascension declined our interview requests, but in a statement, Ascension says its partnership with Google is aimed at improving care and reducing costs. But Joy Pritz, who worked on health information technology policy in the Obama administration, warns that generally, healthcare costs are like whack-a-mole. You cut one cost and another pops up.
You're reducing the cost of a test, well, then you're increasing the frequency of another test.
Pritz says healthcare in the U.S. is a business. Businesses want to protect their profits, and no amount of data will change that. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And President Trump was in New York City today, speaking at the Economic Club of New York. He talked trade, criticized the Fed, as per usual. Not much there for the markets. But speaking of the Fed, Chair Powell testifies to Congress tomorrow, and traders are getting ready for that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The unemployment rate in the U.S. is near a 50-year low. So it follows that claims for unemployment benefits at the state level are also historically low. But eventually, we're likely to hit another recession. And regardless of whether it's as bad as the last one, the Great Recession, it will probably come with some job cuts. And the people cut from those jobs will look to claim those unemployment benefits. Now, how and whether to prepare for this is largely up to the states. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on this from Portland, Oregon.
On a recent weekday afternoon, this Oregon employment office near downtown Portland was pretty busy. People waited to apply for unemployment insurance or check on their benefits. Others sat at computer kiosks searching for jobs online. Oregon's unemployment rate is just 4.1% right now, but some people are still out of work, like Michael Potts, age 54.
I just got laid off last week, so I'm currently looking for work and do a little bit of studying for a CDL, commercial driver's license.
His last job was driving for Amazon, making $16.25 an hour. He expects he'll get about half that in unemployment insurance. He's been through this before, after getting laid off from a grocery store job in 2014.
Having that unemployment helped me out tremendously. I would have lost my apartment and started living on the streets. It's very harsh.
That infusion of cash doesn't just keep workers afloat. Unemployment benefits help keep businesses going. Nick Belaichik is Oregon's state economist.
What they do is help stabilize particularly local economies. So employers are really interested in keeping workers nearby for when the economy starts to recover again. And they also need something to help make up for the lost sales in the area due to people's incomes dropping.
Now, here's how unemployment insurance works. States collect taxes from employers, then pay out benefits from the state's unemployment trust fund to laid off workers. Workers who are fired or quit are usually ineligible, so are temps and contract workers. Benefits usually last 6 months, but when lots of people are unemployed, the federal government sometimes extends benefits for longer and picks up part of the cost. Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project says states can get into trouble.
States went into the last recession with not enough money in their unemployment trust funds, and so they had to borrow a great deal of money.
35 states had to borrow from the feds to cover extended benefits. And many that did, including California, New York, Colorado, and Ohio, still aren't solvent now after years of economic expansion and very low unemployment. According to the Labor Department, 23 states still don't have enough saved in their trust funds to cover a year of benefits in a typical recession. Evermore says they could reform their systems and make employers pay more.
The most obvious step that many states can take is to increase the wage base. So right now, many states are still only taxing the first $7,000 of wages, and that hasn't increased since 1983.
Evermore says some states that now look good on paper, with enough money in their trust funds to remain solvent in a recession, have actually gotten there by reducing unemployment benefits to cut costs. Florida, for instance, has cut the maximum amount and duration of benefits and tightened eligibility rules so fewer unemployed workers qualify.
These reductions have happened in a time of economic expansion, and so we won't really see a macroeconomic effect until the next recession kicks in and broad numbers of people see that benefits have been cut in their state.
In the Great Recession, states borrowed $42 billion from the feds to pay benefits when their trust funds ran out. California just finished paying back its multi-billion dollar debt last year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The uniforms for many police officers around the country have changed in the last few years. Now, much more so than before, they include a body camera. Following increased attention to police shootings of unarmed civilians, particularly black men, many activists demanded body cameras as a tool to help hold police accountable. But now that body cameras are more common and the technology for them is getting better, some are questioning just who the cameras are really keeping an eye on. Sydney Fussell covers tech for the Atlantic, where he wrote about this. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Lay out first for us why body cameras kind of became the go-to solution during the backlash against police shootings of unarmed civilians.
Right. So in 2014, after the very unfortunate death of Michael Brown, there was definitely a push for someone to do something, for the government to do something, for police to do something. And so I think that, number one, it was, it's very visible. So, like, the body camera literally sits right there on the chest. It's something that everyone can see. So I think it became, like, the word of the officer versus the word of an unarmed citizen if they survived the encounter. Some of them didn't and will never be able to hear, their version of events. So I think body cameras were seen as, well, no matter what happens, will have, some type of record or some type of evidence that doesn't just rely purely on the officer.
So how has that worked out?
Well, we're a few years later, and honestly, it's been very scattered is the word that I would use. In the rush to get a bunch of cameras, maybe people didn't think about, like, what it means for them to be used successfully. We just wanted to get the cameras there and think that change would just happen. But just being thoughtful and being able to say, like, well, we want to mandate 25 days after an incident, they should release the camera footage. We want to make sure that it's, an unedited version so we can see everything that happened. Just sort of like setting up those rules and guidelines around release are extremely important in an effective body camera policy. And some places have done that and some places haven't.
Let's talk about facial recognition. As the tech on these body cameras has gotten better, some are equipped with facial recognition software. How does that technology work specifically in a body camera?
Well, facial recognition is something that people have been afraid of since the beginning of the whole body camera push. And so basically, the way to think about it is, if you imagine a checkpoint, people have to wait in line, an officer comes up to you, IDs you, let me see your ID, then they wave you on. But when you think about facial recognition, imagine if an officer just walks by you, you don't even really notice them, and their camera scans your face as you're walking by you. They can match that footage against a database of, people that have outstanding warrants, a database of maybe immigration status or things like that. So the concern with facial recognition and body cameras is that they don't even have to inform you or get your consent at all if they can just scan you when walking by. And so it's very concerning.
California last month banned facial recognition in body cameras, and you're reporting that Customs and Border Protection potentially wants to use this feature. What do you think we're going to see moving forward from states and the federal government in terms of body cameras, facial recognition, artificial intelligence in this space?
I think it'll, you know, and this is just a hypothesis, but I do sort of see it maybe within the 10 to 20, 25 mile radius of the border where ICE and CBP have the most federal protections. I think you'll see it there. I think it's going to depend on, you know, who's sitting in the White House come, you know, January 2021. But if that support continues at the federal level, we'll see sort of like a spreading from broader communities and then, you know, potentially statewide. But I definitely think the nexus is at these like border communities.
Sydney Fussell covers tech for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
like an uncle's name, like a weird uncle's name.
Why that kind of name is just what some companies actually want. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was unchanged, closing at 27,691. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, 0.2%, to finish at 84.86. The S&P 500 was up 4 points, 0.1%, to close at 30.91. Walt Disney rose 1.3% after launching its new streaming service, Disney Plus, today. Netflix shed 0.7%. Facebook brightened 2.5% after it announced a new payments tool that can be used through its apps. Apple's still facing allegations of sexism with its new Apple Card, swiped down less than 0.1%. We were talking about Google's deal with the hospital chain Ascension. Google's parent company, Alphabet, shed less than 0.1%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.92%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. In many rural areas across the country, finding a doctor can be tough, especially for the LGBTQ community. So one doctor fired up their computer and opened a practice offering video visits, like Skyping with your doctor, for gender-diverse patients far away from big cities. This brings us to the latest segment of our series, My Economy, where people share what's going on in their personal economies. This one comes to us from Seattle.
I'm Dr. Crystal Beal, and I'm the physician and owner at QueerDoc. QueerDoc is a totally online doctor's office focused on queer and gender-affirming medicine. Things like hormones for transgender and non-binary people, contraception STI screening, and PrEP for HIV prevention. Unfortunately, there are definitely people who have been totally turned away from a doctor's office for being gender diverse, so just completely refused care. And then there's all the other kind of traumas that happen when we go into the doctor's office when they don't use our name or our pronouns. They don't even have forms that include our gender on them. We might get a doctor who really doesn't know how to offer the medical care we need. QueerDoc is just me and one other provider at this point, so we don't have any credentialing department, billing department. We don't have a referral department or anything like that. When you kind of go to a more traditional clinic system, a large clinic system, they have huge support systems and structures and staffs to do all of those things. Then we just don't have those kind of resources. You know, I don't take insurance, and I offer sliding scale. So some of my patients are paying $25 to talk to me for 45 minutes. And if I was billing insurance and primary care, that would probably be like anywhere from like $300 to $500 that I would be billing for that time. So I do have a part-time job doing addiction medicine. And I, you know, I make a standard paycheck and get benefits and, you know, get paid on a salary hourly kind of basis. And so that's really how I pay my bills right now. I went into medicine because I really couldn't figure out anything else to do with my life. And then I was pretty unhappy doing primary care. I felt really overwhelmed and burnt out. And, you know, I just got the opportunity to work serving my own community and taking care of people who have generally been turned away by the healthcare system. And it's so rewarding to just provide good care and be kind and have them feel safe and not have to worry or be scared about going to the doctor.
Dr. Crystal Beal of Queer Doc. This series only works with your help. Let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org. Mitchell Hartman was talking earlier about how some states are preparing for the next recession, but let's take a look back at the last one. The Great Recession had a lot of lasting consequences in housing, jobs, financial regulations, but it also had a surprising effect on company names, specifically for financial institutions. New banking apps and startups are picking human first names like Dave, Frank, and Bridget. Meredith Haggerty from Vox wrote about this. Meredith, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So obviously this is a branding trend in personal finance apps and startups, but what is the reasoning for these companies in using a first name instead of like a company or product name that just says what it does?
Well, there are a few things at work here, but the primary thing is really just these companies want to sound friendly and human. They want to feel accessible to people. And the best way to do that, or the shortest, simplest way to do that, is with a human name.
But speaking of some of those banks, you have your Charles Schwab's and your J.P. Morgan's and your Morgan Stanley and all these. These are also human names, just like some of these newer apps and startups. So what's the difference?
So often these companies were named following the 1929 crash, and the idea was that you would have an organization that felt institutional and strong and reliable. But when those organizations with those kinds of names failed so spectacularly in 2008, the idea that they were strong and reliable sort of lost their luster.
If you give your bank or your startup a catchy first name, I mean, is it working on these targeted demographics?
I mean, I think it varies like organization to organization. There's so many of them at this point. It's hard to say that they're all working, but I do think that often they do feel effective.
Where are these names even coming from, though?
It varies company to company. Some of the ones that I spoke to, so Dave, which does personal loans, among other things, likes to think of themselves as David and Goliath. They're the little guy to these big banks, but they're casual, so they're Dave. Or Frank, I spoke with Frank does student loans or helps students apply for FAFSA. And the idea there is a play on transparency and frankness. And also, as the founder pointed out to me, like an uncle's name, like a weird uncle's name, I think was her actual quote, which I loved.
Oh, the idea that you might go to your Uncle Frank for advice on something.
Exactly.
One quote that jumped out to me in your piece was from a linguist and branding strategist that you talked to who noted a lot of these apps have, quote, every man white guy names. Expand on that a little bit for me.
The people that I spoke to who came up with the names often said that these names felt like they crossed racial lines. Whether or not that's true, it's a little bit difficult to say. Marcus, Dave, Frank, sure, like lots of people can have these names. But the thing that it stands in contrast to is chatbots, which often have countryless feminized names, Siri, Alexa, Cortana, whereas Dave, Marcus, Frank, these are just like adult men you've met.
So this seems to be appealing to the stereotype that you might go to a man for financial advice, but to a woman for service.
Yeah, you're turning to the patriarchy to help you for financial advice, and you're having a woman, you know, tell you what time it is or the weather or whatever it is.
If younger consumers are so suspicious of big banks and traditional banks, is there reason to believe that just giving somebody a casual first name as your company name is really going to trick someone?
Well, one thing that I didn't have space for in the piece, but eventually these names are going to sound the same. Like the name Bob will sound like TrustCo. Like you will lose this feeling that this is doing anything to you because we become wise to these naming conventions and these sort of marketing gimmicks. So soon enough, I think the first name trend will lose its luster and we won't see it as much.
Meredith Haggerty is deputy editor of The Goods by Vox. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Charles Schwab, which was mentioned in this interview, is one of Marketplace's underwriters. This final note on the way out, lots of folks were amped up to spend the day streaming Disney Plus, but thousands of them struggled to log in or faced error messages when they tried to watch some of the thousands of titles from Disney's back catalog or new offerings like a live-action Lady and the Tramp movie and a miniseries set in the Star Wars universe. Disney blamed the problems on user demand that, quote, exceeded our highest expectations, which, on the one hand, it's like, how did you not anticipate this? But on the other hand, I guess it's a good sign for their eventual bottom line once they get it together. We've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was unchanged. The NASDAQ gained 21 points, 0.2%, and the S&P 500 was up 4 points, 0.1% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Joanne Griffith, Ben Heathcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.